When they reached a district of Zuph, Saul said to the servant who was with him, "Come, let's go back, or my father will stop thinking about the donkeys and start worrying about us." But the servant replied, "Look, in this town there is a man of God. He is highly respected, and everything he says comes true. Let's go there now. Perhaps he will tell us what way to take." Now just flick your eyes across the page to the little number 15 in the left-hand column, verse 15. "Now the day before Saul came, the Lord had revealed this to Samuel. About this time tomorrow, I will send you a man from the land of Benjamin. Anoint him ruler over my people Israel. He will deliver them from the hand of the Philistines. I have looked on my people, for their cry has reached me." When Samuel caught sight of Saul, the Lord said to him, "This is the man I spoke to you about. He will govern my people."
So carrying on from chapter 10. "Then Samuel took a flask of olive oil and poured it on Saul's head and kissed him, saying, 'Has not the Lord anointed you ruler over his inheritance? When you leave me today, you will meet two men near Rachel's tomb at Zelzah on the border of Benjamin. They will say to you, 'The donkeys you set out to look for have been found. And now your father has stopped thinking about them and is worried about you. He is asking, what shall I do about my son?' Then you will go on from there until you reach the great tree of Tabor. Three men going up to worship God at Bethel will meet you there. One will be carrying three young goats, another three loaves of bread, and another a skin of wine. They will greet you and offer you two loaves of bread, which you will accept from them. After that, you will go to Gibeah of God, where there is a Philistine outpost. As you approach the town, you will meet a procession of prophets coming down from the high place with lyres, tambourines, pipes, and harps being played before them, and they will be prophesying. The Spirit of the Lord will come powerfully upon you, and you will prophesy with them, and you will be changed into a different person. Once these signs are fulfilled, do whatever your hand finds to do, for God is with you. Go down ahead of me to Gilgal. I will surely come down to you to sacrifice burnt offerings and fellowship offerings, but you must wait 7 days until I come to you and tell you what you are to do." As Saul turned to leave Samuel, God changed Saul's heart, and all these signs were fulfilled that day. And on to verse 17. Samuel summoned the people of Israel to the Lord at Mizpah and said to them, "This is what the Lord, the God of Israel, says. I brought Israel up out of Egypt, and I delivered you from the power of Egypt and all the kingdoms that oppressed you. But you have now rejected your God, who saves you out of all your disasters and calamities. And you have said, 'No, appoint a king over us.' So now present yourselves before the Lord by your tribes and clans." When Samuel had made all Israel come forward by tribes, the tribe of Benjamin was taken by lot. Then he brought forward the tribe of Benjamin, clan by clan, and Matri's clan was taken. Finally, Saul, son of Kish, was taken. But when they looked for him, he was not to be found. So they inquired further of the Lord, "Has the man come here yet?" And the Lord said, "Yes, he has hidden himself among the supplies." They ran and brought him out, and as he stood among the people, he was a head taller than any of the others. Samuel said to all the people, "Do you see the man the Lord has chosen? There is no one like him among all the people." Then the people shouted, "Long live the king!" Samuel explained to the people the rights and duties of kingship. He wrote them down on a scroll and deposited it before the Lord. Then Samuel dismissed the people to go to their own homes. Saul also went to his house in Gibeah, accompanied by valiant men whose hearts God had touched. But some scoundrels said, "How can this fellow save us?" They despised him and brought him no gifts. But Saul kept silent.
Well, good evening, everybody. My name is Tom Simpson. I'm a member of the staff team here at St. Matthew's, and it's great to be with you. Do keep that passage of 1 Samuel open. It's quite a long passage, which is why we had four different chunks read from it. But it's helpful to consider it as a whole. Although it is quite long. Now, Frank was saying that the youth group on Thursday are going to be attempting some world records. What I'd like us to do now is to recreate our own little psychological experiment. This is a survey that was undertaken back in 2012, and it's all about being on an aeroplane. So what I'd like you to do is I'd like you to imagine that you've just boarded St. Matthew's Airways flight 123. You've strapped yourself into your seat. You're getting ready for takeoff. You've just picked up that that slightly disappointing in-flight magazine that's just trying to sell you stuff. And you can hear the kind of onboard announcement system crackle into life. And the voice sounds out over the announcement system. Good afternoon, everybody. This is your captain speaking. I'm delighted you're flying with us today on the plane. We'll be flying to Alicante. Now, just pause that for a moment. Rewind about 15 seconds. You're still sat in the seat, and that announcement system's come on again. Good afternoon, everybody. This is your captain speaking. We're delighted that you're joining us for a flight here to Alicante. Now, same words, my question for you is, which pilot would you trust more? Pilot one or pilot two? Now, I'm not going to ask you for a show of hands, and we probably wouldn't admit it in public, but I guess for most of us, we'd probably trust pilot two more than pilot one. And my apologies to the West Country for an appalling attempt at a West Country accent. I guess for most of us, that accent fits more with what we're expecting a pilot to sound like. And it's probably the accent that we would trust to be a kind of, you know, good pilot than someone with a regional accent. And actually, that's what that survey showed, that a pilot with a Cockney accent or a Brummy accent, unfortunately, was the least trusted. But the pilots from the home counties were the ones that were most trusted. And the thing I think remarkable about that is that the level of assurance that we feel has nothing to do with the actual ability of the pilot. You know, you could have someone who, with a strong regional accent, who doesn't sound like we're expecting a pilot to sound like, who's done, you know, 10,000 flights, but we trust them less than the person who sounds like they're you know, well-educated, posh, whatever we're expecting our pilot to sound like, but it's their very first flight. We find it difficult to separate appearance and ability, whether that's visual appearance or what someone sounds like. We struggle to differentiate their appearance with their suitability or capability. And as we come to 1 Samuel chapter 9 and 10, that's exactly what the people of God are facing. When we left the people of God last week, we were looking at chapter 8, they had rejected God's leadership. They'd requested a king. And God is going to grant that request. And what we've been waiting for is to see who God is going to choose to be their king. So let's go and meet the king. Now, at the start of chapter 9, we're introduced to Saul of the tribe of Benjamin. And Saul has been assigned a mission. It's a slightly unusual one. He's hunting for some lost donkeys, which, if you're following along, that's verse 3. This is a task that takes him several days away from home with no success. They're at the point of giving up when the servant who is with Saul suggests that they go to the local prophet for help. Let's turn to God. Let's find the man of God. Let's ask him, see if he can help us. So off they go. And lo and behold, it's Samuel, this great prophet who's been leading the people of God. He is the one that they come to. It's not just any prophet. This is the prophet of God, the judge who's been leading God's people. But while Saul may be after some help to find his donkeys, the Lord has other plans for him. He's already spoken to Samuel about Saul. We saw that in verse 15 and 16. He's already been picked out to be the next king of Israel. And so Samuel starts off on the path of crowning Saul as king. Saul, in a section we didn't read, Saul is the guest of honor at a dinner at the end of 1 Samuel chapter 9, and he's crowned king at the start of chapter 10. You see that in chapter 10, verse 1. Samuel takes a flask of olive oil and pours it on his head, which I guess might feel quite weird. I guess we're not used to that, but it is the kind of traditional way in that culture that someone is crowned king. I guess if you're from a different culture or different background, the idea of taking an enormous lump of metal with jewels in it and dumping it on your head, well, that's what we would be expecting to make someone king or queen in this country. It might feel weird if we're from a different culture. He is crowned king. He's given the sign of becoming king at the start of chapter 10. And then through chapter 10, receives all these different signs of having been chosen by God to become king. He's going to receive gifts from strangers. That's the point of verse 3, where they're going to receive some bread and wine. He's going to meet some prophets of God in verse 5. He's going to receive the Spirit of the Lord, and he's going to receive these signs. And I think that's the point of this, is all that it's the marks that God has chosen Saul as king. And then finally, in verse 17, we get this, the bit that we had read, we get this scene where they choose the king by lots. They are basically drawing straws, as it were. And Saul is the one who is chosen. Saul receives sign after sign after sign that he is the king that God has chosen to lead the people of Israel. But that doesn't mean that he is a willing king. He's, in fact, really reluctant. If you look back in chapter 9, verse 21, Samuel says, well, everyone is looking to you. The desire of all Israel is on you and your family. And Saul says, why do you say such a thing? I don't want this. Why do you say such a thing to me? I don't want to know. Then in chapter 10, he won't tell the rest of his family that he's been anointed king. He hides it from them in chapter 10, verses 15 and 16. He keeps all the details secret. And then at the end of chapter 10, again, that section that we had read, the people, the tribe, the family line, the exact family grouping are all chosen by lot. And I guess Saul must feel that this is inevitable. So in verse 22, he knows it's going to be him who's chosen. So he takes himself off and he hides. He doesn't want to know. He doesn't want to have anything to do with it. He's called to be king, but really he'd rather hide. This doesn't feel like a great choice, does it? I mean, you know, let's give us to put it in a slightly different scenario. So imagine I stand up at the front of church and say, hi, I'm leading a new team here at St. Matthew's with them to go and do something, but I don't really think it should be me leading it. I'm not really interested. I'm not up for the job. In fact, I don't really want to be here at all. How does that make you feel? It's not exactly inspiring, is it? Like it just doesn't leave you feeling great. It doesn't excite you about the task that is at hand. Is this really the right person for the job? I think we're supposed to be asking that question as we read this. And the thing is, Saul's reluctance doesn't just impact himself. It impacts everyone who's following him because it just makes them really uncomfortable. Now, Saul may not have wanted the job, but he is most definitely the people's choice for king. It started all the way back at the start of chapter 9. I'm sorry that we're going to be flicking around, but it's part of the story as a whole. Look at verse 2. Kish had a son named Saul, as handsome a young man as could be found anywhere in Israel, and he was a head taller than anyone else. Now, as I was reading this, I was trying to work out what this would look like in practice, and this was the best combination I could come up with. Now, in the Irish rugby team, there is a guy called Devin Toner. It's this guy. Now, this might not seem particularly dramatic in this picture, although he's obviously a bit taller. For comparison, that guy is the same height as me. He's 6'11" or 2 meters 11 centimeters. And in a rugby team of massive people, he is head and shoulders taller than everyone else. That's the kind of impression that we're going with here. And the thing about being that tall is that he stands out. If you're watching a match and he's playing, you can tell where he is. It's always obvious. And that's what Saul is like in Israel. He's a head taller than everyone else. And not only that, he's really handsome. He's the most handsome guy in Israel. And so what you end up with is not just a guy who's massive, but a guy who's a bit like that. And yes, I have just pasted Chris Hemsworth's face over Devin Toner's body. Saul looks fabulous. And he looks like just the person you want to have lead a nation. And I think that's why, as you go through the story of chapter 9 and chapter 10, however much Saul doesn't want to have anything to do with being the king, all the people are like, yeah, this guy's great. He's massive and he looks fabulous. He's exactly what the people were looking for. And in fact, if you were to flick back to the end of chapter 8, that's exactly what they wanted. In chapter 8, verses 19 and 20, they said, we want a king over us. Then we shall be like all the other nations, with a king to lead us and to go out before us and to fight our battles. And Saul comes along, and he's massive, and he's handsome. And if you're going into battle, if you want someone to lead you, you want the big guy who looks great. You want someone to hide behind. You say, hey, this is the guy we want. He's great. And the thing is, before we realize that this is just the faults of the Israelites, this is something that just affected them. No, this is all of us. We are all... We all lean towards picking the big person or the beautiful person. And that's not just, you know, PE at school. Well, you know, the sporty person gets chosen first. Actually, there was an academic paper published in 2020 by some guys in a university in Hanover in Germany. They were investigating candidates applying for jobs. And so they took a load of pictures of candidates. They took a load of CVs and they randomized them. They just mixed them all up and then they put all these candidates before an interview panel. And it showed that the candidate who was the most physically beautiful stood a better chance of being appointed. You know, even in a kind of randomized trial, looks win out, even over ability. It's the same reason why when you want to advertise clothes, you don't pick normal people off the street. You pick a model, some strapping bloke or beautiful woman. And so we come back to Saul, and because he's tall and he's handsome, well, he must be the right guy for the job. He must be the right person. What more could you possibly want to lead God's people? And so at the end of chapter 10, they ran out and brought him out. This is verse 23. And as he stood among the people, he was a head taller than everyone else. And Samuel said to all the people, do you want the man the Lord has chosen? There is no one like him among all the people. And all the people shouted, long live the king! He's tall, he's good looking. He must be the man for the job. And when we finished last week, we were waiting to see what the promised king of God would look like. And as we've gone through chapters 9 and 10, it feels a bit of a mess. Because actually, as you go through chapter 9 and 10, it becomes even less clear. Because we get a whole series of rhetorical questions, a whole series of questions where we're just not quite sure how we're supposed to answer. Just follow them through with me. So in chapter 9, verse 20, there's a little dialogue between Samuel and Saul. We've looked at it a little bit already. And to whom is all the desire of Israel turned? Is it not to you and your whole family? Well, is it? I don't know. I think they're supposed to be watching Saul and his family, but is this a good thing? Is this the right person? Then in verse 21, Saul answers, is he not from the smallest tribe? This tribe might be small, but he's huge. In that same verse, why do you say such a thing to me? Surely Saul can't have been so dim as to have missed what all Israel has been saying for the whole of the previous chapter, that they want a king. Is Saul just completely oblivious to what's been going on? Carry on in chapter 10, verse 1. Samuel takes this flask of oil, pours it all over Saul's head. Has not the Lord anointed you ruler over his inheritance? Has he? Why phrase it as a question? It's not clear. It's ambiguous. Through this carries on through chapter 10, verses 11 and 12. Is Saul also among the prophets? I don't know. He seems to be. Might be. Verse 27, right at the end of the chapter. Some people look at God's king, the one who's been chosen by lot. How can this fellow save us? I don't know. Can this fellow save us? He seems pretty unwilling to be king. He looks great. But is he? Can this fellow save us? Now, normally at birthday parties, we sing happy birthday, don't we? We sing it, happy birthday to the birthday person. It's not always plain sailing, though, is it? Because I don't know if you've ever been at a party where, well, maybe people aren't necessarily the strongest singers, and somebody starts, and unless there's someone with a bit of oomph, it kind of all can get all a bit awkward. There's a bit of, confusion, and maybe it ends up petering out through the second and third lines. There's that confusion and uncertainty. And as we read through chapters 9 and 10, I think that's what we're supposed to feel as we read this passage. We know what the people are aiming for. They want this kind of impressive, powerful king. But it's not what we get. We're supposed to get to the end of it, I think, and say, well, is this really the king? Is this the right person? Because although he looks like the right person, he doesn't want the job, and it's a bit uncertain whether God really is choosing him. Is this the right guy? Can he save us? And so the Israelites are coming face to face with the problem that we started with at the beginning of the passage, the beginning of our time together. There's a difference between someone's appearance and someone's ability. Just because he's strapping and handsome doesn't mean that he's actually cut out to be the leader of God's people. And before we think that's just a kind of a political problem for the people of Israel, the leader of God's people, God's king, is much more than someone who just makes economic or political decisions. It influences how closely God's people follow God's ways. So that when the leader of God's people is faithful, they do well. But when he's not faithful to God's ways, they turn away from God. Who the people of God are following as their leader, well, it's hugely significant. And I think that's where the rubber hits the road for us too. The Israelites, as we finish chapter 10, face an uncertain future because they've prioritized appearance over everything else. And we're not immune from the same affliction that impacted them. We might not be choosing a king, but we make all sorts of decisions that are hugely significant. Now, it might be practical decisions, like who are we going to let influence us? Who are we going to choose as our friends? Are they going to be the people who are going to be good for us, or the people who just look great? But it's also got a spiritual element too. Who are we going to let influence us around us? Well, you know, who are we going to choose for a church? We were thinking, what Claire said earlier, September is a time of change in Cambridge. People moving, people going, whether for jobs or university or whatever. And so if you're a Christian, you might be choosing a church. We might come across a church that's very whizzy and shiny and looks very impressive, does all sorts of fabulous things. But is it actually teaching the Christian faith as the Bible intends? You know, a slick preacher and great music can be great, but it doesn't mean that the church is actually teaching God's truth. Or how about the school or university CU that's not filled with the cool people or does the coolest things? Is that going to mean we're going to write it off? Or that slightly cringy Christian friend at work? Will we prioritize being a faithful brother or sister to them? We need to examine ourselves and see if we're judging the appearance of these things rather than the ability of them. Because the thing is, what God thinks is important isn't always what the world around us says is important or impressive. And we shouldn't be surprised by this, because actually that's exactly what we find when we look at the Lord Jesus. Because Jesus Christ stands in exact contrast to Saul. Whereas Saul was the most handsome man in Israel, Isaiah 53, verse 2 says, Jesus had no beauty or majesty to attract us to him. Nothing in his appearance that we should desire him. Jesus doesn't look impressive. He was never going to be the one picked first in PE. He was never going to be a model for a clothesline. There was nothing that would make us desire him from outward appearance. But the Lord Jesus is exactly the person we need to lead us, because he is the one we should be trusting, because he's the only one who is able to save us. As Jesus says in John chapter 12, the one who looks at me is seeing the one who sent me. It might not look impressive by our worldly standards, but that's exactly what God knows we need to see. It might not be handsome by our contemporary standards, but the beauty of God far supersedes merely what the eye can see. And so as we finish, we need to examine ourselves and our motivations. What are we looking for in Jesus? Do we want someone impressive? You know, the ripped hero figure? The one that everyone admires and adores? Because that's not the Lord Jesus. He died a weak and lonely death on a cross. He preached a message that looks foolish and weak. He may not look great on the outside. He may not speak with the finest philosophical methods that the universities would be so impressed with. But he is the savior of the world. He is the true king, the one who is able to lead us to follow God. Jesus is the king we need. He is the one that we follow. And what are we looking for in the people who follow Jesus? How are we going to react if that slightly embarrassing person from church comes up and talks to us when you're talking with your friends? How are you going to react when the church isn't keeping up with the culture or copying the latest styles and trends? The church may not look impressive or dynamic, but it's exactly the right thing we need to hear where the word is God is preached.